Welcome to Record Roulette. My name is Eamon O'Flynn. I'm here with Nathan Smith to discuss another album from the Rolling Stone 500 Greatest Albums list. We're back, Nathan. We did it. You have a good summer?
Yeah, it was all right. As far as summers go, I'm not generally a fan of summers. I'm more of a winter. No, it was great.
Yeah.
How about you? How about you, Eamon?
It was just wonderful. What a brilliant time to be away from this podcast and enjoy the. No, I'm like you. I'm looking forward to getting back to this. That was garbage. That was terrible. That was like torture. And now I'm ready for this thing. As everyone listening may know, this episode we'll be talking about John Mayer's Continuum with the lovely and talented Alison Rapp. Alison is a music journalist who you'll often find writing for Ultimate Classic Rock. She has interviewed Ann Wilson, The Black Crowes, Judy Collins, John Oates, and Peter Frampton, among others, and is a return guest on Record Roulette for some reason. It's wonderful to have you back, Alison.
Thank you for having me back. It's good to be here.
Now, I mean, we're already questioning this because of your choice today. So you're the first guest that we've had choose an album from the Rolling Stone list rather than just coming from a random number. And you, a music journalist, chose a John Mayer album. Please explain.
You probably shouldn't have people choose this stuff. I mean, that was on you. That was my, you did ask. So I chose.
Lesson learned, first episode.
You know, and it's funny because I got to tell you, if I had a dollar for every time I've gotten a reaction like that from other people, this kind of confused look when it comes to John Mayer, I'd probably have enough money to finance another Continuum album. It's just one of those things. But I mean, I'll just be upfront and honest from the start. I mean, I'm a John Mayer fan. I have been for several years. The first time I saw him was on that very first Dead & Company tour that he did. That was 2015, I believe. And I remember at the time thinking, I don't really know about this. Like, this seems kind of weird. I don't know if this is really going to be a good fit. And it turned out to be quite a good fit, at least I thought. And I kind of worked my way backward from there. And I think Continuum was, if not the first, one of the first John Mayer albums that I listened to probably start to finish. And so I've been kind of following his work, you know, ever since. I've seen him another time with Dead & Company, and I've seen him solo as well. Actually, I saw him at Madison Square Garden a couple of years ago when he played the whole Continuum album from start to finish, which was really, really cool. So, you know, I mean, it's a favorite of mine. I think it's a really well-crafted LP. I think it's a good example of, you know, what people kind of call the John Mayer, like, sound style, whatever. And you know, it's always held a special place in my heart.
I have a quick question about that concert.
Yeah.
When he did the concert, did he try to do it like the album? Did he try to mimic the sound of the album, or did he, you know, cause like sometimes the concert version sounds different. I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah. I mean, it was a few years ago now. I do recall him sticking pretty closely to the original arrangements and what the studio version sounded like. There might have been a couple of, you know, slightly more extended jams. They weren't necessarily jam sessions per se, but slightly more extended, like solo breaks and that kind of thing. And obviously, you know, it inherently sounded a bit different because he was working with his touring band and not the people that he had on the album. But, yeah. You know, for the most part, it was pretty concise because he had to fit the whole album into, you know, one set. So it was pretty close.
Okay. All right. You know, I think the thing about this podcast is you have to keep your mind open. I mean, we did it with Brian Eno. Brian Eno forces you to keep your mind open. So, you know, like, I mean, we can do this. We can do this, Nathan. We can do this. Nathan, were you surprised at all that John Mayer had an album on the list?
Yeah, I was quite surprised, actually. I've looked at the list and then I've skimmed it through various points throughout the history of this podcast, and certain names jump out, and this was one that I don't even remember sort of seeing in passing. So for some reason didn't register to me earlier. So it's not like, oh yeah, we'll get to
that
John Mayer. Yeah, but I figured that would make it easier. Like, you kind of start at the end, so something would have registered, but it just never stuck in my mind that, oh yeah, it's kind of weird that John Mayer has an album. Maybe we'll get to it. So I was surprised that I hadn't seen it, and then that he has one on the top 500 at all, and that it was this one.
No Bob Seger, no Tina Turner, but John Mayer. Very odd. And there is, I know for anyone listening, there is an Ike and Tina album. It's garbage. I don't consider that a real Tina Turner album. Had you ever heard this before, Nathan?
No, I'd heard first song for sure, as I think most people on the planet,
everyone
can attest,
has heard.
But I sort of felt like, you can get into this in greater detail, that I'd sort of heard other songs before in different ways. Like, it feels very familiar. And it just, so I don't know. I guess it depends on sort of when this album reaches you and at what point in your life and under what circumstances. For me, I was listening to it for the purposes of this podcast multiple times. And it felt to me a lot like kind of something you put on in the background and do other things while it's playing.
I think the weird thing about this album, like you said, I've not really paid very much attention to John Mayer. By 2006, when this came out, I was kind of like, already had my set of music, and I am not a music journalist, and that's the whole concept here, is that I have no clue what happened in music after a certain date, and which was about 1980. But
which is weird because you were not born at that time, so you're
I was not born at the time, no. I was not alive. But there's songs on here, I feel like Vultures and Gravity, I thought I had heard before. I don't know, I think maybe only one of, maybe Belief as well. Like, there was a few on here where I felt like I'd heard them before, so I don't know where. They must be in movies or something. For those who did skip our last episode, which we released a short 101 on Continuum last week, here's the basics. It came out in 2006. It's on the Rolling Stone list at number 486. It was big commercial success, got some mixed critical reception, and it won 2 Grammys. Pretty straightforward, which, you know, like, that's pretty solid. You're on the list of the greatest albums of all time, and you've won a bunch of Grammys and made a bunch of money. That's pretty successful, in my opinion. But let's get right into the discussion. Now, the very first question I set up here was because I had a preconception of John Mayer before listening to this. And that was because most of my exposure to him had been with things he had done with, like, B.B. King. Like, there's videos of him playing with B.B. King, Eric Clapton, and is it Crossroads Festival, doing that kind of stuff. And so I think of him as a guy who has this reputation as a kind of almost guitar god-ish guy, which is actually kind of unique these days, I think. And I think that's helped along the live album that came out right before this, called Try. Do you think that this album supports that kind of persona, Allison?
Yes and no. I mean, I certainly wouldn't point to Continuum as being like the John Mayer guitar god album that people should listen to. I think, you know, like you said, he has this reputation for having that talent, especially playing with people like that and rubbing shoulders with people like that. But I think maybe more so, Continuum points to the idea of John Mayer being a guitarist who's also a songwriter and who can craft a really, you know, well put together song and can do both on the same record. And that, I think, kind of sets him apart in and of itself. I mean, you don't necessarily have that many people who have that level of talent on both ends. I think the strength more so of Continuum, beyond just like the, you know, obviously talented guitar work that's on it, is the fact that it's made up of so many just well-crafted songs that are structured really well. They're clear, they're concise. You know, this is a pretty brief album. It clocks in around 50 minutes, a little less. That's my favorite length for a kind of album. I mean, if you listen to
Nathan's sweet spot.
Yeah, 45 to 50 minutes. That's what you're looking
for. Yeah, it's funny. Over at My Classic Rock, we have a little series called The 45-Minute Police. We'll take an album that's over like an hour and we'll cut it down to 45 minutes, which is what
now that's an idea.
Appropriate length.
It's a great public service you're doing.
It is. And there's so many of those albums where you think, man, this needs to be like 5 songs shorter at least.
Yep.
But then, you know, and you put that up against people like B.B. King and Eric Clapton and all those other people who, you know, their albums just don't, they're not crafted in the same way like that. Those are people who are guitarists who also happen to write songs. This is more like a songwriter who plays guitar really well. And I also think that comes through in, you know, a lot of the guitar work on this album in particular is it sounds almost vocal. There's like a lyrical quality to it almost. He plays guitar like a singer would. So, I mean, if you're looking for John Mayer guitar god, this is probably not the album you should start with. But, you know, it's a good jumping off point.
Yeah, I started in that kind of area, and I kind of bounced around a little bit, because at first I was like, well, no, not really. It's a little bit too poppy for that. And then I realized that he's kind of a unique guy, especially in, like, say, the 2000s. Like you said, a singer, songwriter, and guitarist, an actually very good guitarist. There's not actually that many really well-known groups where, you know, or artists in 2006 that are led by someone who's doing all of those things. And mm-hmm. and then on top of that, we're talking about a pop album that has a guitar solo, and not just like a small guitar solo, a decently lengthy guitar solo on, I'd say, at least 50% of the songs here, which is also kind of a little bit of an outlier, I think. So as I went back, I was like, this is almost like he's almost using pop and saying, hey, guess what? I can fit this. Like, I can fit my guitar work into this. I don't need to, because the previous live album, Try, he does do a little bit more of that. And there's a little bit more distortion and stuff. He doesn't have the same clean kind of tone in the guitar. But then he comes to do this, and at first I thought it was too light and fluffy. And then I started listening. Every time I listened more, I'd be like, well, wait a second, he's doing some interesting stuff here. And then, you know, obviously you get to Bold as Love, and he kind of does his Jimi Hendrix impression, and there you go. What about you, Nathan? What do you think?
No, I mean, I think the points are well made on the musicianship and the guitar playing specifically. I think you know, clearly he's quite capable as a guitar player in the traditional or typical way, if and when he wants to be. But as you've said, he's not shredding throughout this album. I think he's playing in a more mm-hmm. restrained sort of way. It sort of reminded me at times of the way that Mark Knopfler plays when we listen to Dire Straits.
I have that written down here. Mark Knopfler.
You know, he did that album in, I think, season two, if you want to go back and listen. But yes. I mean, he's another guy that can play whatever he wants, clearly, and however he wants, but he tends to be a little bit more subtle more often than not. And I thought, the more I listened to this, the more that sort of reminded me of those kinds of sounds and tones, where there's still really interesting little fills he's doing, but he's not just playing fast for the sake of playing fast or running up and down the fretboard for the sake of proving he can do it. He's kind of moved a bit beyond that, I would think. And so he's kind of challenging himself in different ways and how he can use the instrument, either through, you know, even just different effects and sounds he's getting out of the guitar and the pedals and the amps, or just how he's using that as a, not a rhythm instrument, not quite a lead instrument, but almost a complementary instrument to others that are in the mix. So I did find that part of it kind of interesting and unique.
Mm-hmm. It's funny you should say that too, because I remember during lockdown, I'm pretty sure John Mayer did like a little mini series where he would kind of break down some of his songs on Instagram Live, and he would do those videos. And he did a couple from Continuum where he sort of broke down these riffs, and they're deceptively simple. Like, there's not really actually that much going on there. It makes it sound a little bit more complicated, but the way he was breaking it down, mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, he's very capable without being, you know, too much of a showman.
Yeah. Last season we talked about a Guns N' Roses album, Appetite for Destruction, and our guest was a guitarist, and he was kind of breaking down some of that, and he was like, Slash's stuff is not as complex as you might think either. And The Edge, for instance, with U2, that sometimes it's just really clever ways of putting something like that together. And I think Mayer does that a bunch of times. And Mark Knopfler was the name that I'd written down. Another one was Rivers Cuomo, who I think has the ability. He can write the songs, he can play the guitar, and he will play some really crazy, especially live. I think he'll go a little bit more nuts with some guitar work. But, you know, in the songs, it's rarely crazy overpowering, and it serves the song. But I would say I thought that the solo, or just basically Bold as Love in its entirety, was fantastically done. I think you picked Jimi Hendrix. I mean, he's one of the greatest guitarists of all time. And it's like going in a singing competition against Freddie Mercury. Like, how do you step up and do it? And he did it. And I kept listening back and forth to two different versions, to Hendrix playing it and this one. And I actually kind of prefer this. By the end, I was like, well, I mean, Hendrix is doing the first version. That's the hardest one to do. And Mayer's doing the edit. But he used a much cleaner kind of tone in the guitar than Hendrix did. And it just came together so nicely. I thought it was cool to see something that's such a well-known song get added to in 2006.
For sure.
You know, one of the big parts of the narrative around this album was that after releasing a bunch of pop-oriented adult contemporary albums, Mayer wanted to pivot to the blues and rock music that he loves so much. Do you think he was successful? Like, does this feel like a blues slash rock album, or is it more of the same but with some great PR, Allison?
Yeah, I can see both sides of that coin, really, mm-hmm. but I don't know that if you'd asked me flat out, I don't think I would label it off the bat as a blues rock album. I certainly hear the blues rock tinge to it, but I don't necessarily think that he crossed that line so far as to lose the people that he'd already, you know, gained as fans in those couple of other years. Obviously, you know, now that we're coming at this from a retrospective angle and we have the 20 years of work that John Mayer did after Continuum, I mean, it's very clear to see the kind of progression that he took there. But at the time, I certainly probably, you know, I wouldn't have thought that. To me, I mean, R&B is the more prominent influence here than blues rock in any way. And I think a ton of that comes from Steve Jordan on the drums and Pino Palladino on the bass. Those guys to me are at the heart of this record. And if those two men weren't on it, I don't think that this would have the kind of groove that Continuum mm-hmm. has to me.
Yeah, that's the I landed in R&B, and even some of the songs, I'm gonna find another you, for instance, like that almost.
Yeah,
I actually thought when I was listening to it a few more times earlier today, and I thought, is this a cover? Like, I had to go actually look it up, because it sounded so much like something I could imagine Otis Redding singing to. Like, if you stuck his voice in there somehow magically, I think it would turn into an amazing Otis Redding song.
Yeah.
But that heavy kind of sound that, you know, everything I read, even the way that that Rolling Stone kind of sets up this album in their description, why it's on the list, is very much like, oh, he tapped into that blues and rock that he loves so much. Nathan, did you hear that blues and rock anywhere?
Eamon, I did not. So now, in defense of the publicist, when they said that he wanted to tap into, was that the quote, that he wanted to tap? Maybe it was just like a general mission statement. They didn't mean that it applied to this album. Like, he wants to at some point do it. It might not be this album. It might be an album down the road. But no, I think what Allison said, you know, R&B, like soul, maybe a little bit. But I just, and, you know, blues and especially rock is such a wide umbrella that a lot can fit under that. And it's very subjective naturally. But I don't hear a lot of, even sort of giving a generous interpretation, what I would consider to be blues. And again, there's a lot of things that can be blues, but I don't see or hear anything there. Rock, you know, maybe, like, I think it's more of a, not quite traditional R&B, not quite funk, but more kind of soul, like on that side of the spectrum. And, you know, just kind of easy listening, soft pop, that kind of thing. But yeah, I'm not sure how much play or attraction those initial statements received, but I think that really probably created false expectations for a lot of people, because clearly he's capable of doing that, as he's demonstrated multiple times since, and as you said before, Eamon, prior. So it just seemed like a very, when you have that statement in the write-up as part of the show notes, I was very like, what do you mean, like, this was his move into rock and blues? And I started listening to it with those ears, trying to, is there something? And I couldn't really, unless, like I said, you consider soul kind of a cousin of the blues, and that's what they're getting at, but I didn't hear much of it.
You know, my theory here is that he put out a couple of, you know, multi-platinum albums that are very much in, like, the pop kind of adult contemporary space, and then he went off and he did all this stuff with Clapton and B.B. King, because that kind of happens after that second one, and then he put out a live album with Steve Jordan and Pino Palladino, I believe, are the two that played with him. For that live album, the John Mayer Trio, and it's heavier. Like, it has a heavier feel to it. It's at House of Blues, I think. It's got I think it does have a bit more of a blues kind of emphasis to it, and a bit more rock to it. And I almost feel like someone listened to that and said, oh, that's the thing, we can grab onto that and talk about, you know, like that element of who he is, and that'll be the thing for the next album. And I think there's a little bit of that. Like I said, I think there's a lot of guitar for a pure pop album. Like, I know it's not coming from the same family, but the Timberlake album, the Justin Timberlake album that came out at the same time, what is that? The one, the Sexy Back, what's it called? It's killing me.
Sounds or
yeah, that's it.
I don't know if that's
Future
it.
Sex
yeah,
Love
I got,
Sounds.
I
Future
got a
Sex
few words, right? Don't give me full credit. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Good enough. Close enough.
But like, it's a totally different, you know, like, it's not, I think that's pretty representative of like that element of pop music at the time. Like, you have James Blunt with You're Beautiful. Like, that's a totally different, like, I almost feel like that's closer to what John Mayer could be if you didn't have that more active guitar kind of feel to it, which I think is a bit more of the, it coming from that tradition of like the blues and of rock and roll. And even when I was listening earlier today, I started thinking to myself, well, what if I listened to this and thought about rock as something from the 60s rather than something from the 70s and 80s? When I think about rock being like a heavy thing, that's distortion. When I think about the Kinks, like early Kinks or early Beatles or something, it's not the same. You're not putting the same onus on that. I don't know where he's drawing from, although he is playing a Hendrix song, so so you'd think that it's heavier. But
just to go back to your point about the live versus being in the studio, I mean, as I understand it, that was more or less the reason that this album kind of came to be, was that the three of those guys were playing a lot together, mm-hmm. and they were on tour, and I thought, man, we could maybe translate this into a studio thing. And I actually saw earlier this year at the, there's an annual charity concert here in New York called Love Rocks, New York City, which is like a food bank donation concert. And they always have a ton of stars playing. And this year, the pinnacle of the show was this reunification of the John Mayer trio, all three of those guys playing live together. And you're right. I mean, they played a few songs from Continuum. I mean, I know Vultures was definitely in their little set list, and it's definitely a much heavier, just deeper sound overall. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a lot of that, Steve Jordan is a very meticulous drummer, and he's a very meticulous producer as well. And, you know, that obviously comes across in the studio versions of those songs, certainly. Yeah, I mean, I would certainly encourage that anybody who wants to listen to Continuum should certainly listen to the live stuff before that and put two and two together, because they're just apples and oranges.
Yeah, there is a part of me that wonders, like, that's where I kind of started to wonder, because I went to listen to Try right after this, and I was like, oh, okay, so these are the same guys. They're just doing something heavier when they're alive. And I think I almost prefer that, but I want to make it clear that I actually liked this. I think these are just the interesting places or the interesting elements of where this album is, and in almost in terms of how it's being sold in something mm-hmm. like Rolling Stone as like, here's why it should be on the list. I think you can make an argument for why it should be on the list without trying to build up like its rock and blues credentials. You know, I think that just alone, you know, it sold like crazy. It won multiple Grammys. It's a, you know, it is an interesting, like I said, I think it's a bit of an outlier in certain ways from just pop generally at that time. And I think if you're looking for an album to represent 2006 in the pop space, I mean, or even, you know, mid 2000s in the pop space, you're probably going to have a hard time finding something that's more interesting. That's where my opinion kind of lays here, just in case anyone's wondering why I'm like hammering on the, why is it not blues? But you know, I've mentioned Rolling Stone's write-up a couple of times. So the write-up for this album seems to suggest the lyrics were kind of insightful, and especially the deceptively self-aware take on generational apathy from waiting on the world to change. What do you think about the writing on this album, Allison? I know you've already kind of talked a little bit about his writing, but you want to speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll be totally honest. I don't love that song, and I love this album. I can certainly concede that it's a little kitschy, maybe is the word, and I don't necessarily think it's all that representative of the rest of the album. And I can certainly understand that, like, you might start this album from the start and think, oh boy. And there are sometimes when I start the album, I think, man, I really wish it didn't start with that, or I wish it wasn't on here at all, because I just don't know that it necessarily fits the way I want it to. And I know it's become something of a running joke for people, and I totally get it. But I definitely think that after that song, the writing gets a lot stronger. I mean, I Don't Trust Myself with Loving You, I think, is really great. Gravity is obviously one of the best on the album. There's a sort of Can I swear on this show?
You can go for it. Say whatever you want.
There's this sort of like sad fuckboy kind of vibe to Continuum that I, for whatever reason, as not a sad fuckboy, am like attracted to and find like really interesting to listen to. I did a podcast with somebody recently who described this vibe as like the art of the fuckboy. And I think that's kind of where this fits with Continuum. There's something, you know, kind of pretentious about the lyrics that are still sort of, I don't know, it's smooth to me. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, like the lyrics in Slow Dancing in a Burning Room. And he's got that line about, you know, you'll be a bitch because you can. And I realized that, you know, now, like close to 20 years down the line, there's some people who might take some issue with a line like that. But I think it kind of speaks to that art of the fuckboy sort of, you know, genre, if you will, that has kind of only gained in popularity since then. I think, you know, Continuum to me at least is a really good example of an album with writing that highlights the idea that you can be both heartbroken and sad and disappointed, but also remorseful and spiteful and angry and all of those things at the same time. And you can do it all in one song. You can even do it from line to line. I think especially now people tend to have this idea that like, if you have an album like this, a heartbreak album, a breakup album, it either has to be sad and sorry for yourself or angry and revengeful. And I think this is a good example of an album that has all of that in one.
I'm sorry, Mom. I didn't realize she was going to say the word so many times.
That's the thing.
But
come on, yeah,
that's it. It just kept like going. It just kept going and going and going.
Bleep that out.
There's a lot of bleeps. I can't pay for that many bleeps. Nathan, you know how much they cost? Each one of them. It's so expensive. Nathan, what about you? What do you think about the writing here?
It was okay, and especially given the genre, like it's better than average, I would say, for the genre, for what's on the radio at the time or what was sort of considered pop at the time. Like it's better than the average, but I wouldn't say that it's a strength per se. It's fairly literal, a lot of it, which is fine if it doesn't need to be sort of abstract or whatever, but it's fairly literal. It's, you know, the themes are pretty tough to, I just find it's usually difficult to rate the lyrics of, you know, pop music because they're all, there's only like three themes that have ever been written about really in different ways. So to critique themes is a bit much for me, but I think it's easiest to summarize it, as I said, sort of right off the top to repeat myself, that I don't think it's a strength of his, but given what was around at the time and given what was on the radio and he clearly was and what was getting played on TV and elsewhere, it's above average, but it's not something I would say that he is an amazing lyricist that has, it's multi-layered and I just think it fits the music. It's just like a 6.5 out of 10.
That's pretty good.
I don't want this to, because I've said plenty of dumb sounding things on this podcast, as anyone who listens knows. But it's funny to me that like I've read a bunch of interviews with John Mayer where I'm like, I'm surprised this guy can write anything. He says some really weird shit. And, you know, like, you're like, how is he putting anything down? Are you kidding? Like there is an extended quote that I saw about him talking about the name Continuum because he was really, it's like, man, I've really been thinking about time recently, you know, time and like gravity. I came up with gravity and I was like, just, it's always pulling against me. I was like, that's really deep. And I'm like, what? But to me, this is really surprising, this album, because, you know, for a guy that I read quotes and I'm like, all right, I don't know what's going on here. But, you know, he wrote songs about the pitfalls of belief and conviction. He wrote a song about the drive and kind of challenges behind attaining like greatness and fame and that sort of stuff. He wrote about coming to terms with mortality on this album. This is a pop album. The very first song, I disagree with Rolling Stone. They say it's about generational apathy. I think it's about generational almost like frustration, not apathy. It's an angry song, I think, about, you know, we're being shut out. We can see all these things that are going wrong and we don't have any ability to do anything about it. And just wait is literally the message. Just wait. Yeah. You know, this is a pop album. Like, there's not that many songs, you know, the thing to go back to in pop albums, you know, like the really, a really generic pop album is like 75 to 80%, maybe more, of, you know, some sort of love song or breakup song or something like that. And that's only 25% of the album, maybe. Like, it's not a, you know, it does have everything you're talking about, Allison, but it's not necessarily the heavy side of the album in terms of the themes. And I think that's, it surprised me that, you know, for someone, someone who wrote Your Body is a Wonderland to have this album with all these other kind of really interesting things in them. That, to your point, Nathan, I do think that sometimes it's a little overly literal or a little overly simplistic in the way that's being delivered, but it's interesting to even go after those things at all in this sort of album. So yeah, that's one thing that I kept coming back to is, you know, if you're trying to find something to represent pop music around this time, this is an interesting little outlier.
I think that the literal part that you guys are talking about, I certainly see that. But I think for me, that was an appealing part, because I feel like so much of, I hear so much, there's a lot of hiding behind metaphors in contemporary pop music and in 2006 too. And that just drives me up a wall. I hate it so much. So, you know, like listening to something like this, where it's a lot more or less abstract is, I don't know, I find that refreshing.
So when doing some of the research for this episode, so I did read a bunch of different reviews that came out at the time. Matt Coller from AllMusic called it a, quote, gorgeously produced, brilliantly stripped to basics album that incorporates blues, soft funk, R&B, folk, and pop in a sound that is totally owned by Mayer. But others weren't so friendly, including Slant Magazine's Jonathan Keefe, who wrote that, quote, with no edge to the songwriting and with such spit-polished, tasteful production, Continuum just doesn't convince as a heady, soulful rock album or as Mayer's creative quantum leap forward. Which take do you think most aligns with your thinking? And I'll note that, see, that's even in the quote from a review that happened at the time, people talking about what everyone heard was this was a soulful rock album, or this, you know, it had these blues elements. So this is always there. Like, this isn't like some weird thing that we've attributed later or anything. It was always part of the discussion to me, which is odd. But which of those two takes, or where do you fit on that? I think it's almost a spectrum here, a continuum, if you will. Allison, where do you fall on that continuum?
Well, I mean, I can see kind of both ends of it, and I'm not entirely sure if spit polish is supposed to be a criticism in this sense, because I mean, there's plenty of people who really love the spit polish like production sound. And again, I think that a lot of that goes back to Steve Jordan and his meticulous playing and production style. I mean, I think of people like Jeff Lynne, for example, who has that really hyper produced, like clean, almost artificial, like sounding thing in the studio. And that can be really great in a lot of aspects. And I think it actually works on Continuum. So I don't think of the spit polished production as a bad thing on Continuum. You know, you're right. I had, before you'd even said that, it hadn't occurred to me that the word blues just keeps appearing and appearing and appearing in this. And it's almost like people were hearing it so much at the time that they didn't know what else to write. I don't know. I want to take elements of like both of those criticisms and put them together almost. Like I do think it's stripped to basics, and I also think it's spit polished at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it's to me, it's like the spit polish thing, I think, is that it is very cleanly produced. And I think that's kind of nice in this case, because I think you can hear each of the players really clearly. Like, there's no like almost lack of distortion, like on things. Even the guitar work is not distorted, like, ever. It's pretty clean almost all the time, and I think it gives you an appreciation of the actual players. But what about you, Nathan? Where do you fit on that continuum?
Well, I think, yeah, I don't know, it's
on the continuum. Continuum, where do you fit?
I think that, like, this is where maybe the sort of pre-hype or what they're trying to describe the album as starts to become its own enemy, because if you go into it thinking that it's supposed to be blues or rock or kind of soul or something like that, where traditionally the production is a bit looser and there's kind of, you can sort of have some mistakes that you leave in or slips, or it just feels a bit more organic, and then you hear this, like, that's not blues, or that's not real soul, there's no soul, it's just very like clean and slick. But I think in terms of, you just come at it objectively and with an open mind, that the production, the way it is on this album, fits the songs and these songs mm-hmm. wouldn't sound the way they should, I think, if it was kind of gritty and loose and kind of, you know, it sounds a little bit more unhinged. Like, I think the way these songs were written sort of demand or almost prefer the type of production that we heard. And it is like, again, if you don't like slick production at all, then you're not going to like this. But if you can kind of respect the art and the work that goes into that kind of style, like, this is really well done. Like, to your point, you can hear the instruments, like, they're really well separated without sounding, you know, all in the left channel, center, like, they blend well, but you can still pick them out individually and you can hear the playing. Vocals are well produced. Like, yeah, it's a really well produced album if you like that style. And even if you don't, I think based on the songs on this album, that's the kind of style that they demand.
Yeah, I think it's to me, it's kind of it's a bit of both kind of approaches or both reviews. I do think it's well produced. It definitely sounds like John Mayer. I think it sounds mm-hmm. like his other earlier work too. I think that's partly his voice. I think his voice is just is a very unique kind of thing, and I think he's very airy and almost like flat's not the right word, but it's just like the kind of tone to his voice is very consistent across a lot of the songs. Like, he doesn't really get like worked up. I don't know a better way of saying that. And again, like the live album that comes out right before this, they do play, it is a little bit looser. It is a little bit grungier. And his voice does get a little bit more kind of energetic. And so if you're listening, if you want that kind of thing, go listen to that album. But this is a different album. The one thing I just kind of take some issue with is in addition to calling it a rocky and bluesy kind of album, I think part of that conversation is about John Mayer taking this big leap away from what he used to do. And I don't think it's really that. And that's kind of what that second one's referring to, this creative quantum leap forward. You know, like, we've listened to, like, this isn't Springsteen doing Nebraska. Like, I was a giant fan of Nebraska, but Nebraska is very different from what came before it. It's not Neil Young doing On the Beach and saying, I'm going to purposefully do something that sounds different and grungier and stuff. There's nothing in the studio here, for instance, that makes it sound like, all right, you know, everyone thinks of me as a slick produced pop machine. Now I'm going to make this, you know, I'm going to get Steve Albini in here and we're going to, you know, like that. None of that comes across here. So to me, it is in the middle. Like, it's there is no, I think both of them are pushing in different directions. One's overly positive, one's overly kind of negative. But what was your favorite song on Continuum? Nathan, I'm going to start with you this time.
Let's see. It's hard to, I don't know. This first I was sort of saying,
are you scanning the song list now?
No, I'm trying. It's one of those ones where sort of, I don't want to say like, I like them all the same, but there's, I don't know. They sort of like, to me, kind of
all right, Sonia, together.
Hold on. I'll go with Slow Dancing in a Burning Room. I can't go with Waiting on the World to Change. And I agree just to the point earlier, because I don't think we're going to get to the track selection, but I thought that was a really strange track to start with. And just when I first started playing the album, yeah, I started the album without looking at the first track. I'm like, did I just hit sort of shuffle by accident, or did I hit the wrong song? I just felt like a really weird song to begin with, but yeah, I'd go with Slow Dancing in a Burning Room. It's a nice melody. It's good production. I think it sort of summarizes the album well. But I can't say that I love that head and shoulders above all the others, as you heard from my delayed lead in there to finally arrive on it.
Well, while you just mentioned it, like, what were your thoughts on the way the album was put together? Because I agree that it's odd to start with that song. I think that's a weird one to start with.
Yeah, well, I think once you get out of that opening track, which just threw me, and I guess Allison as well, for I don't know what reason, it just felt peculiar. After that, I thought it flowed pretty well. Like, there's not a lot of sort of hard left turns and then like, oh, it slows down and it speeds up. Like, it's a pretty steady sort of, you can tell the songs were written. I don't think he had, you know, so I've had this one for 10 years and this one I just wrote in the studio. Like, it sort of feels and sounds like they're all written of the same time, you know, not necessarily in a week, but in the same sort of general time frame, because they do fit and it feels very sort of thematic in a sense.
All right, Allison, same questions.
I think my favorite, is that what we're going with now? I think my favorite is I'm Gonna Find Another You, which is the last track on the album, which is
the Otis Redding song.
Talked a little bit about. Yeah, the Otis Redding song. You know, and it's funny you said what you said, because I feel like I remember having the same experience where I thought, like, who wrote this? Like, I didn't believe that it was a John Mayer song or something like that. You know, concise, succinct. The guitar work is really nice. I think his vocal is really great. Simple. Just a really, that to me is probably the most like bluesy quote unquote song on probably the whole album. I think it just ties everything up really nicely.
All right. I'm going to go with Belief, but I had a real challenge with Belief, Bold as Love, and In Repair. And I think the kind of interesting thing there is Belief and In Repair. I don't think he's the lead guitarist in one of them. I think it's Ben Harper. And I think the other one is Charlie Hunter, maybe. I'm not sure if he's playing the lead on In Repair, or if it's John Mayer, one of the two of them. So I think it's a little weird that I picked two songs that have guest guitarists.
Yeah. In honor of Sonia.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. I've picked half the album. Yeah. Nathan, do you understand why this is on the list? Do you see why this is on the list? And would you have put it there?
I don't understand why it's on the list, and I would not have put it there, but I'm open to hearing reasons. I'm open to being convinced. I just did, again, decent album, but it feels like there's a lot of albums like this in the history of music. And so I'm curious, what about lots of albums have won Grammys, even multiple, like as in two Grammys for whatever year it was, but you don't have all of them on the list. So I'm curious, what about this culturally, commercially, artistically, from both of you, in particular, Allison, because that's why we're here, why this merits a spot on the list. That's why we're here.
Yes, Allison, you take that on.
I think it goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of the show, which was that, I mean, it's a really well-crafted LP. The songs themselves are well-crafted, and when put together, with the exception of Waiting for the World to Change at the top, it's a very well-put-together album. And like we said at the top, you know, there weren't that many guitarists / singer-songwriters who had kind of the equal level of talent on both hands making an album like that. I think that is probably what inched its way onto the bottom of the list, is just the kind of overall talent through the whole album that you know, John Mayer obviously showed on that. You know, would I put it on the list like now if you made me write a list of 500 albums? Maybe not. I don't know. But, you know, I can certainly understand why, in terms, like, from a songwriting craftsmanship perspective, that part I understand why it's on the list, certainly.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same. I think there's different types of albums that are on this list. There's ones that are just like the big albums, you know, like have to be there. There's ones that are kind of crazy and weird and a little experimental. You know, like we've talked about Suicide by Suicide, but, you know, like Brian Eno's got a couple on there that are a bit wild and, you know, are not super commercial albums. But then there are ones that I think they're being recognized because they're just so damn good at being pop music from their era. You know, I think Saturday Night Fever, for instance, is on here. And it's just, you know, there's a lot of disco and stuff going on at the time, but the Bee Gees were just better at writing songs than everyone else in that era, you know, in the pop world. And I think that's where this almost fits, is that it's like, you're talking about the early 2000s, what's going on in the early 2000s in this genre, and what's the best representation of like the most interesting thing that's happening in pop at that time, because there's other genres also being represented with other albums here. So there's plenty of hip hop from that era on this list as well. And so, you know, like I said, I enjoyed it. And it's not perfect, but none of the albums we've covered are. But I think the one thing that is always challenging with something like this is a lot of the albums we talk about have decades of history. And you're able to look back at them and say, like, Nebraska over time, you know, people are still talking about that. People, you know, we talked during that episode where we covered it. People are still being like, that's my Nebraska, when they make some crazy new sound. And, you know, do people still talk about this album now? Is it going to hold up 20 years from now? Or will it fall off the list? It's already in a really precarious place. So there's a part of me that's like, it's just barely grasping on right now. That doesn't mean I don't like it. It just means I have a tough time seeing it staying there long term. So I did pull a couple of one bad opinions. So it's more like two bad opinions from Amazon. If you guys would like to hear them, would you like to hear some bad opinions?
Always.
Yes. For people who are only tuning in for the first time right now, this is, you know, I mean, even they're bad reviews of great albums or very good albums.
And so, can I say, we're still looking for a sponsor for this segment. So,
yes,
if somebody wants to sponsor One Bad Opinion, by all means, reach out.
Yep. Yep. That's it. Yep. Rolling Stone, for instance. If you'd like to hear us bash your magazine over and over again every single episode,
Amazon should really own the One Bad Opinion sponsorship.
They should. That would be a great spot for them. Yeah, it'd be really real opportunity. So there were 3,118 ratings here, 4.8 star average. So only 2% were one star. I actually pulled two of them because I felt like one came from a person who was not, in fact, a John Mayer fan, and another was a John Mayer fan. So the first one is tastefully titled "My Ears Are Bleeding," and here it goes. Can someone please explain what the record company was smoking when they collectively said, "Yes, let's record and produce this"? I've heard more pleasant sounds coming from malfunctioning power tools and flatulent livestock. John Mayer simply sounds horrible. Just because somebody recorded it doesn't mean it's worth listening to. I would rather have a root canal or pass a kidney stone than sit through a John Mayer CD. That's from Ryan in 2007. So right after the album came out. And then, so it didn't sound, because it was like rather than a John Mayer CD, I assumed that that was not a John Mayer fan. So I pulled this other one, which is called "This CD Was a Major Disappointment from a Great Artist." John Mayer's first two CDs were great. Some of the best music I've heard in a very long time. This CD was awful. John, you're not an R&B singer like Al Green, Sam Cooke, etc. Stick to the rock/pop. It's all right to have a touch of R&B/blues, but stick to what you do best. With the exception of track 6, this album was a total waste of money. Buy it used. That's from R. Conway in 2006.
Vultures was their only saving grace in the whole album? Wow.
Apparently, that's it. Yep. So, yeah, there you go. That's those are the bad opinions. Would you recommend this to other people, and why, Allison? I mean, you recommended it to us. I kind of feel did. By just bringing it to us.
Yes, but as we've said before, earlier in the episode, I think it would be worth it to listen to the live, you know, record probably after, I would say, maybe just so you can kind of get the difference between the studio or I don't know. I don't know if it really matters either which way that you might listen to that, but I would certainly recommend listening to both. So you get the full, as you said, continuum of this sound.
The continuum of John Mayer. yes. Nathan, what about you? Would you recommend this, and why or why not?
I don't know if I go out of my way to recommend it. If somebody asked me, "Hey, I'm thinking of listening to this. What do you think?" I'm like, "Yeah, go ahead. You can, it's good. You're not going to be, I can't imagine anybody turning it off in disgust." But I also, once somebody gets through it, I can't imagine saying, "I got to play that again," or "I can't wait to listen. There's so many things I got to discover." So I wouldn't go out of my way to recommend it. But if somebody said, "Hey, I'm thinking of streaming this John Mayer album," Nathan, should I? In the unlikely event that that conversation occurs, I would, I'd say, yeah, I'd give them my blessing.
You tell them to buy it used.
or just get a Spotify thing. You can have the entire library.
Oh, great idea. Yeah, I liked it. If you're looking for like a bluesy kind of album, I'd go for that live album, as you mentioned, Allison. But I think is a good album. If you take it for what it actually is, rather than whatever Wikipedia or Rolling Stone or reviewers tell you it was supposed to be, I think it's a good album with good music. So that's it for today. Before we sign off, where can people find your work, Allison?
I am a writer at ultimateclassicrock.com, so you can find my work there. And I am on Twitter at AllisonRapp22.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
That's all for today. Check out Record Roulette on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at RRMusicPod. Rate and review this podcast wherever you can. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite show, or listen for free at recordroulettepodcast.com. Music in this episode is from Lemon Music Studio. Thank you for listening to Record Roulette. Until the next spin, goodbye.